This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Media. I'm Jeff Adler, speaking today with Robert Willem. Robert is an artist and culture analyst who works as senior lecturer and associate professor of digital cultures at Lund University in Sweden. We are speaking today about Robert's new book, Mundania: How and Where Technologies Are Made Ordinary, published by Bristol University Press in February 2024. In his book, Robert takes the reader on a journey through the realm of Mundania, a realm that is both familiar and incomprehensible, banal and uncanny. Mundania is the realm in which technology that seemed unspeakable before its arrival becomes an everyday fixture of a life, and more specifically, mundane. Robert Willem, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
So to start out, what is Mundania and why did you choose to explore it?
Okay, what is Mundania? For me, Mundania is a proposal. It's a proposal to imagine differently about complex technologies, about emerging technologies. And I see it as a kind of imaginary version of our everyday life. And also, I play with the idea that it could be this realm that is semi-geographical, but also sort of imaginary in itself. So it's a kind of sort of way to make people think differently about their everyday life with complex technologies.
And why did you find it interesting?
It's based on my research about digital technologies that I've been doing for some time, and also some autistic practice in relation to that. And what I found fascinating is that since I started studying like internet consultants at the millennium, it's so surprising how much of the technologies that are really a lot of buzz around it just sort of seeps into the background hum of everyday life. And it does that sort of, it happens all the time. It's going to happen with AI in various ways too now. And especially now, since we are having these shifts and debates about new technologies like AI, I found it interesting to start looking at everyday life and all these mundane, almost banal technologies and how they interact with the most recent technologies and how they formulate or how that in relation to people's very everyday lives and routines and so, how that becomes entangled in various ways. And I thought Mundania and the idea about a process I call mundanization was a good starting point for this.
Okay, let's go there then. What exactly is like this idea of mundanization?
Yeah, what is mundanization? Like in media theory and within science and technology studies, and so we do a lot of talk about technologies becoming domesticated. Like they become tame, part of everyday life, like television, computers, and so on. And of course, these things are integrated in people's lives, like in your life, in my life, in the one using them. They're sort of, we are busy doing something else while we use the technologies. But I started to ponder on the idea that about taming these technologies. To what extent do we really tame them? So I wanted to have an addition to this idea about domestication and came up with this idea about, suggested mundanization, where technologies become ordinary, banal, but at the same time, slightly uncanny. Also almost a little bit weird when we start thinking about how they really works. And the question is then, what is really tamed? What do we have control over when we are working with these kind of networked, very complex technologies? So that's mundanization, is a way to capture that kind of process through which these complex, convoluted technologies become part of everyday life, but still sort of remain out of grasp and being incomprehensible in many ways.
So just to make sure, so I find the challenge here is that, you know, after reading your book, yeah, I mean, you sort of see Mundania absolutely everywhere. I mean, you know, just before this call, we're talking on Zoom, there's some issues with the sign-on, And we said, okay, it's part of life. When it's actually, exactly, an extremely complicated process going on to just get a sentence to Zoom. But can you give any examples that you find had to resonate with people that really show just how uncanny this process of mundanization is?
I see that the sort of uncanniness or the kind of weird dimensions of it sort of pops up now and then, and mostly it's not experienced as uncanny weird. We feel it like sort of it's more or less banal and ordinary when we use it. But sometimes something happens. For example, you get an email sent from yourself to yourself, sort of you get these strange messages. This sometimes glitches, but sometimes also maybe features that you don't really understand why they are there. You start thinking about files that suddenly maybe seem to have moved somewhere, or then you start wondering, okay, I put this there in the cloud. Where is it really? Sync issues between different technologies that with the calendars sort of that suddenly just think disappear and pop up again. And so, and of course, you can say that, from a technological or engineering or development or software development or interface design sort of perspective, that, it's about glitches and about sort of malfunctions that will be corrected and so on. But the question is, when all of these things become more and more incomprehensible, as we all talked a little bit before about when we talk about Zoom, for example, how much is really possible to comprehend among this? And especially since it's also connected to very large corporations and business plans and ideas and plans and strategies that we don't know very much about. For example, we are all the time relying on that when we use software as part of our everyday life. We rely on that soon a new update will come and sort of correct the stuff that doesn't work so well. And we also we are expecting that the providers of services and products that we are having deals with, that we offer us these things that we use, that they will remain, they will stay there. They will not go out of business. They will not change. But suddenly, sort of, someone changes their business strategy or their sort of platforms. And then you have to sort of adapt to that. And that might, for some people, feel awkward. And They are quite complex, not just processes, but the whole sort of assemblage of stuff that we use is very convoluted.
So, okay, I want to then jump ahead to a question I was going to ask later. But one thing I found, there is an interesting kind of theme in your book, which is that there clearly is some kind of political element. Like, you talk about how these technologies aren't tame. They could be weapons of destruction. At the same time, they could be revolutionary. But, you know, you don't actually say, hey, it's a conspiracy. These companies are making these complex. And so a question I have is, does this process of utterly incomprehensible technologies becoming part of our everyday lives, if you can think about it, like, is it a modern phenomenon related to corporations and the world we're in, or is it part of the human condition? Is it part of human psychology?
I think something happens when these sort of systems become more complicated. But I really want to stress that it's not about any conspiracy theory or anything. Because I think that's to jump to conclusions about some sort of conspiracy is something I really advocate that we don't do. Instead, I should say that, okay, there's some dimension of critique in it, but I should say curiosity first, then critique.
Okay.
So we have to be curious about this. We have to think from time to time, question how is this, what's really happening here? What are these deals? What was that sort of click wrap agreement that I just sort of said yes to? So I think it's good. And what is this? What are the sort of the downsides to this kind of convenience and comfort that I get through these new kind of technologies? I think we should ask questions about that, but we shouldn't come with some kind of pre-formulated critique that it's one way or another, or some or some kind of conspiracy. We have to stay curious, I think, and also stop thinking. One of the things that I really want to stress also that we stop thinking about the things that we often think are quite boring or banal, like all this. I write, for an example, about everything from small interface elements to email or antennas or power buttons. It's interesting to think about how did all of these things become part of everyday life and now so taken for granted.
Okay, I love that. I like that you clearly drew the distinction between, curiosity and critique. And yeah, your book is very careful in that way. So I wanted to ask, you said people should stay curious where they see even, yeah, exactly, like power buttons or more obviously complicated technologies like AI. We should stay curious. We should ask what's happening. But I want to ask, what does it really mean to stay curious? Because, for example, if I see a power button, I don't think you're saying, go talk to a developer who designed the button. Go talk, like, you mean it in some deeper level. So what does it really actually mean to investigate mundania and to really try to figure out what's going on here?
Yeah, I think it's about, of course, people have different possibilities in their lives to sort of get access to knowledge about stuff and so on, about all the sort of things they're using. And that's something also I want to be clear about, that there are very, very many different variations of mundania. The way I evoke mundania is a proposal from my point of view, where I can see something, other kinds of things I can't see, I can't comprehend. I can comprehend some things, other ones, things I can't. For some other person, it would be different. And so the thing I encourage people is to sort of think from their own position in life. If you start thinking about everyday life with the complex technologies, how would mundania take form for you? How would your life with mundania be? And for example, just by starting thinking about these banal things and why are they shaped in a certain way? How are they interconnected? And they're not just about functionalities, but also sort of almost some kind of existential dimension of it all too. What does it mean to when your identity sort of is dispersed through technologies, which is gradually become more and more when the feed you use in social media, when that's that kind of mirroring of yourself, where when you just glance a little too long on a post, that's going to sort of speak back to you in a certain way, because you're going to get back more content in that kind of that have that character. What does that mean for the way you sort of engage with the technologies? And I mean, when we get the more advanced AI assisted services, it's going to be even more advanced. This kind of mirror play between yourself and the technological environment. Yeah. So yeah. It's not about such sort of revealing stuff in per se, but also to accept that there are, for example, in the book I write about the certain properties like opacity, order, and variability, and see how they, for example, relate to various ways that everyday life with technologies unfold.
You want to go through some of those properties and just whichever you want to be talking about?
Yeah, sure. For example, let's say opacity. There's been, when it comes to technologies and when to digital technologies the way they've been proposed and talked about, there's a lot of talk about transparency or explainability when it comes to AI, and now, for example. But I think we also have to acknowledge that that's a certain kind of opacity that will always be there. The idea about, for example, when you black box technology is a black box to put in it, you get this kind of way of simply and conveniently use something because the complexity is hidden within software or the way it's constructed and so on. The idea that you can get some kind of insight by just opening the black box, I think it's a metaphor that doesn't work, functions well often. It is based on the idea that transparency is about sort of, if you just sort of open the lid, you will understand it. But it's instead, it's more kind of it's a process. It's more about relations. It's about Certain things will be kept secret due to various reasons. It's sort of non-disclosure agreements and warranty void if seal is broken and all of this stuff. And So opacity is quite interesting. This interplay between transparency and opacity. And and I can say that too. In the book that I often use sort of I shouldn't say historic examples in that sense that they are there to sort of where I want to show some tell some history of something, but I use historic examples as part of this more meandering probings of various themes. For example, I write about transparency and the almost fetishization of glass that you can see in tech business. You know, when all the headquarters have this, the largest curled sheet of glass in the world, and show that everything is sort of visible, and glass is still this material that has this aura around. In a very way, it's very similar to the way it was used in the early 20th century. As part of the idea about Bauhaus, modernism, and so on, or in the late 19th century, you know, where they had these glass palaces, so this utopian material glass, and how that's always how that almost becomes metaphorically come back in sort of Amazon's spheres in Seattle, Apple's headquarters, and I play with the idea that also this idea about the fiber optic cables through which this light speed of information is sort of and data is flowing through these glass fiber optic cables. How that's also some kind of almost, it's a nice sort of continuation of the idea about the glass as this utopic material. So I have this kind of ways of discussing, for example, opacity through these kind of meandering stories. And a similar way I do with sort of order and variability.
Yeah, your example of the glass, I quite like that. You know, it reminds me of in the 90s, there was that kind of funny trend where phones that were not yet cell phones, they would be see-through plastic, you'd see all the wires. And the whole point was not that it was transparent. It was, look how cool and complicated this thing. Mm-hmm. But now they're saying, look, it's glass, you can see through it, it's all very there. But it's, of course, like, you know, whether you call being able to see something, whether you call it clear, whether transparency is associated with honesty and comprehensibility versus complexity is up to whoever is telling the story, really.
Great to bring up that kind of aesthetic choice, you know, when you have this transparent cover of something and show that, okay, inside here, you can see that, there's some complicated stuff inside there. There's some, like, microchips and so on. But it's not about sort of any transparency that provides any specific knowledge or insight. It's more kind of aesthetic choice. And that's interesting how that is sort of plays out in various ways. And this kind of, this is almost like this museum glass box example. And I also use that as to play with the idea about these things that are put inside this box of glass, and how you can see it. But after a while, when you try to move, you can't touch it. And then when you come too close, you're going to sort of hit your face in the glass box, and you can't reach it. And also, at some certain angles, you see what's inside the box, but you also see your own reflection through the glass. And so these kind of diffractions and everything. Yeah, it's interesting to think about glasses. It's a material that it's nice to think with it and to use as this metaphor and analytical and probing behind.
To switch gears slightly, you discussed earlier about how you implore people to look around at mundania, knowing that, you know, your mundania is different than mine, that our own experience will shape what we see around us. And you talk a few times in the book how your experience was shaped being, I guess, growing up in urban middle-class Sweden. And so how does that experience kind of inform this whole thing?
It becomes starting point of the sort of kind of stories I tell. And I realized that I've done a lot of, through my career, working as a researcher, I've done a lot of ethnography and done field works and everything like that, and tried to tell people stories and, you know, just looking at the, you're doing this participant observation. And I wanted to, in this book, take a very minimalist point of departure where I start with my own example. See, how can I distill some kind of stories and knowledges from those small examples. And since they become so small, they also become, I shouldn't say universal, but they can make sense for other ones. For example, one of the things is that I stare closely at my own the computer screen. For the ones using a computer, that would be the same thing. You know, when you look at the button with the arrow, that and how that shifts sort of guys, when you move it along different windows along the screen, and if you work with a user experience or a human-computer interaction, everything like that, it's going to say something specific for you. But also, for everyone's just using it and not knowing much about it, you can still play with the idea that when you move this arrow over the screen, it moves also between different areas, not just different APIs and different sort of. But let's say when it's leaving Apple and moving into Microsoft and so on, from the Apple Finder, and when it moves into Microsoft, that's a very, very small thing happening. But to some extent, it opens up doors to what I call brand versus. I take the word universe as a point of departure. So I think, okay, what is a universe? Yeah, the idea about universe is that a versus. Versus come from Latin. Verse come from Latin versus, which means to sort of to make a furrow, to make some, to create something that gets a certain shape. That, for example, that a farmer is plowing the fields and making this kind of ordered furrows along the field, and that's a kind of versing. And the idea about universe is that when everything is kind of molded into this kind of uniform order or logic of the universe. And when you start thinking about brand versus, that would be sort of when companies are creating furrows, not just sort of creating brand scapes or sort of this kind of brand, imagine where they have their color codes and everything, but also the way this very software, for example, these arrows and windows and swiping and scrolling, how did that it sort of made, it's also makes certain things possible and others not, and it will shape us in certain ways, and we will be part of the shaping. So, you know, this kind of versing and the establishment of brand versus, that's part of something that's, I shouldn't say that it's universal or that it's for everyone, but I can take a very personal part of departure that is this very small thing happening when I move the cursor or the arrow over the screen. But I can still tell a story that maybe it's relevant for other ones. But it's also interesting to get you other ones thinking, okay, what would I see when I look at my screen and move that arrow? And what would, and stop there. Think about these really small things.
So the idea is that, like, even the littlest sort of action displays an entire ecosystem behind it.
Yeah, an ecosystem, or also a very convoluted, I shouldn't say the universe, but I mean a convoluted world that's unfolded based on different brand versus different, and I also play with this three orientations of mundania in the book, and also just three suggestions, but I play with the three orientations in between, beyond and beneath. And the idea is then that if we talk about technology that we use, there's this kind of phenomenological idea about technologies that are vanishing for us when we use them. When I'm using a hammer, I don't think about the hammer until it breaks or something. When I use a smartphone or when we use Zoom, if everything works, we don't think about how Zoom is built up. But when suddenly when something, a window pops up that doesn't use... usually it's not there. We have to think about the interface and not on us engaging through the tool or so on. And if we think then about the technologies as being these things that we engage with and that we do things with, then I play with this idea about the vanishing points. If they are all of the points of engagement are also vanishing points, And if where technologies seemingly vanish, and if they seemingly vanish, where do they go? Then I play with it. They could go in between, they could go beyond or beneath. And in between would then be that they sort of become ambient in the way that you sort of, like Mark Weissick proposed, like call technology, and other ones have said that they're like pervasive, ubiquitous computing and so on, that they become part of the atmosphere almost. And technologies can be sort of environment, media can be environmental, it can be create this kind of ecologies of media where they are just around us in various ways. And then when it's about they being beyond, it's about this kind of geographical beyond where we engage with certain network things that, for example, what do we engage with? You are sitting somewhere on a different continent than I. So, of course, we engage with each other through this, but we also engage with all the data centers and all the things that are connected to this whole sort of melange of things that makes this possible. And so that's the beyond. And that's not just geographically beyond. It's also the kind of imaginative, imaginary beyond, because it's about also how our imaginaries unfold about these things that are not present here. What does it... How do I think when I use GPS, I start thinking about, yes, it's all these satellites that sort of orbiting Earth that I'm interacting with now. That also opens up this kind of vast expanse of imaginations. And beneath is, of course, then about infrastructures and about things residing beneath or under stuff. And also not just beneath, sort of dig down into streets and through ducts of cables and so on, but also sort of beneath the level of sort of almost subliminally under the sort of surface of attention and so on. Yeah. So these are the three orientations I try to paint out in the book.
Yeah. Mm. So has this curiosity, has this exploration of mundania, have you gotten to the point of critique? You said curiosity and then critique. Are you still exploring, or have you gotten to the point of having a few or however many things of, I don't, yeah, critique, point yeah. of critique?
I think when it comes to critique, it should be more sort of, then we should have, would have to be more specific about it. Like mundania, I tried to paint a quite blurry or imaginative picture. And from that, I wouldn't formulate any specific universal critique. But of course, you can look at specific deals or arrangement or that we can be critical towards, or also sort of start thinking, okay, what are the implications of this? What are the implications of certain business models about, for example, let's say it's social media that has to do with the focusing on content or engagement that are polarizing people. So I mean, that's what are implications of I shouldn't say a specific critique, but it's what we have to sort of be aware of. What does it mean that almost everyone is walking around with a camera in their phone in there? And how does that change sort of, how does that change the way people socialize? How that chase other person, and it doesn't mean that they have to be sort of say that it's necessarily good or bad per se, but we have to sort of follow and see what does it mean for the way people engage with the world, with each other, and what does it mean for societies and for how different futures unfold. And I also try to sort of, when I'm doing my research, that I talk with people that work in different fields where they and try having dialogues with different stakeholders and discuss issues with them and so on. And then I have to be more sort of granular and start thinking about what does it mean if a certain municipality use this kind of AI technology? And then, but then I have, yeah. Have to be a more concrete. So I'm using mundania, this book, more as an opening, a way to start thinking. And then when it comes to critique, we have to be more specific, I think.
Okay. That makes sense. So along that line of sort of using technology to look ahead. One thing I've always found quite peculiar about our current moment is that the people building this technology and the general cultural conversation is obsessed with being the future. Everyone's always saying, the sci-fi books of, the 80s and 90s never are becoming true. We will be in other planets. We will, we're similar in whatever Space Odyssey series, or, we'll have a cyberpunk world we live in. And I don't think ever before were technologists that conscious of trying to make depictions of the future that existed. So how does this idea that we are building something unimaginable that used to only exist in science fiction, how does the notion of mundania inform this kind of self-conscious obsession with building the future?
One peculiar thing that has to do with what you described now is how this extreme focus on building futures, or about sort of creating futures and being the first into the future and being ahead of everyone else, sort of jumping on the train before everyone else does, for example, when it comes to innovation and so on, is that also creates a kind of, how should I say, it creates a kind of quite predictable idea about what is innovation and how sort of things could unfold. In the book, for example, I write a little bit about this, how Apple marketed their Macintosh in 94 by using this metaphor of Orwell's 1984. And the idea about this kind of the way new technologies should pop up and be disruptive and revolutionary that was used then has become a kind of, it's become so predictable that when a new technology comes, it is always sort of promoted as if it was sort of this total new thing. And I mean, when it's certain things can be more disruptive than otherwise, but when you launch a new smartphone or a new thing and talk about that, this extremely disruptive thing that takes us into the future, and then it's just about sort of some more pixels in the camera or something else. You know, this kind of rhetoric about being revolutionary and being sort of fast and being speedy, and so it's it creates this idea about a very predictable idea about following the hype cycle into the future, and or I also used the idea about curve surfing, where we have this idea about we are surfing like this mental or imaginary curves, with the early adapters followed by the large majority, and then come to laggards and see that all the technologies follow the same thing, and we have to start with startups has this crappy software that in some way manage to get it out, and then after that they sort of make it into something better, and then they scale it up, and suddenly we are there with this new thing. Sometimes, I don't know. I think there's a kind of predictable scheme, or that template, a path dependency of imagination that always seems to pop up when it comes to this futuring and talk about the future. It's a little, look like a little bit like I see the streamlined sort of rockets from the 1950s coming back again and again.
Okay, that's a good transition to my final question, which is, I completely agree that when you're so obsessed with seeing the future, you have a very tunnel vision view of the future. You're only seeing what you sort of already thought of, But as you said in this conversation, and as you say in the book, the important thing is to stay curious and to keep an open mind and sort of not get too tunnel visioned on critique, whatever it might be. So as a final question, how can you just give us a message? How can everyone listening to this podcast episode, how can they start exploring this realm of mundania?
They don't necessarily have to sort of take my suggestion about, for example, these orientations or properties as point of departure to sort of put those templates on their own reality. I should see that. But if someone looks at this or listen to us now and get inspired by this kind of way of trying to think about things that seem to be incomprehensible and how the banal and ordinary is interplaying with the new, and how your own routines in everyday life, how that sort of it's becomes enmeshed with complex technologies that make certain things possible, but otherwise not possible. And to start thinking about the complexity of all of this and really try not to just say, yeah, it's too complex, we can't understand it, but instead try to maybe imagine differently about technologies and challenge yourself. And yeah, what could we learn from a 19th century novel about today? What could we learn from artworks? How can we learn from sound art when it comes to that is, but what is noise and what is not noise and what is information, what is not? So I could sort of go on and give examples, but I think like in the book I try to take some very small points of departure to sort of start thinking about how you can start with the most banal things and see how, for example, how you use a dishwasher or how you use what does it mean with a timer on the, let's say, connected to the power button in the staircase? What is it that, what can you learn from looking at the way battery time is sort of formulated the way you live when you search for sort of power sockets, and how does sort of the life of a battery engage relate to your own sort of patterns or rhythms of everyday life? And stop with these small things and see how you can get inspired by those. Maybe start questioning some things, try to be curious and find new, try to understand stuff that is related to technologies and techno-social sort of economical circumstances.
Brilliant. I think that is a great way to send off. Robert Rillum, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. Nice to talk to you. Thanks a lot.